This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've talked in the past on this program about and with entrepreneurs, and we all know what they do. We also know that we are living in what has been described as an entrepreneurial economy. The entrepreneur's goal is to make money. And we also talked in the past on this program about and with social entrepreneurs. We just didn't know what to call them. They didn't know to call them that, at least. It's a category that is just beginning to emerge. Social entrepreneurs make change, not in terms of coins in your pocket, but the kind of change that makes a difference in people's lives and makes the world a better place. J.D. Lewis and Molly Barker, both Charlatteans, fit that description. Molly has been a social entrepreneur for years, though she maybe never thought of herself that way. We'll ask. She started an organization called Girls on the Run to help young girls approaching their teen years to not only have a better self-image, but to understand how to construct that image themselves and not have it dictated by outside forces. J.D. Lewis came to our attention because his teenage son wanted to know, as people of affluence in comparison to millions of others in the world, why did he and his family not do more for those people? So J.D. made sure they did. He started something called 12 in 12, which allowed him and his sons to spend a month in 12 different areas of the world where people face significant challenges. The idea was to visit, learn about those challenges, and lend a hand in helping people overcome those difficulties. That year-long trip is over, but the work continues, and we want to explore that work a little more with J.D. and with Molly because they have joined forces. We also want to explore this idea of social entrepreneurship. So they're both back with us again for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Did you consider yourself a social entrepreneur, either of you, when you first embarked on these adventures?
You know, I started Girls on the Run in 1996 and had no clue what social entrepreneurship was and learned of that language, I guess, around 2002. And as I began to hear the language around it, I was like, wow, that's me. And it was like very affirming to know that I'm not totally obsessive about wanting to change the world. Like, there are other people that feel that way, too. So it was very helpful.
But there's a lot of people who feel that way. Not too many people actually get off the sofa and do it. Yeah. When did you consider yourself to be a social entrepreneur, Jay?
I think that probably happened about 3 weeks ago when Molly called me a social entrepreneur. I don't think in terms of that, but I guess that I certainly am. I guess I fit the description.
Well, you started life and still are an actor, and right, and you teach acting. And so all actors, if they're doing it full time, are entrepreneurs.
Certainly are.
They are the business.
Absolutely.
They are the brand. So you have some background, I guess, in that. Define the term. What is a social entrepreneur? Is there a definition for it?
There is a definition. I don't know it by heart, but I'll tell you what my definition is. It's a person who is basically trying to change systems so that all spirits can thrive. So what is successful to us is not measured in dollars or revenue or income. It's successful in whether we see the light go off in the eye of someone, whether we're creating a change in someone's life for the better. And it's we become incredibly obsessed. We can't stop. You know, we're very driven people, almost at times to our own detriment.
Right.
You know? So
as you went around the world with your sons, and you went to every continent, 12 different countries in 12 months, including
right,
our own, you spent time in Mississippi. Did you see the light go off in people's eyes?
Absolutely. And I saw the light go off in my kids' eyes, and that was the most important thing for me. And I think for my kids to get it, and they have both turned out to be people who want to make a difference in the world, and I think that's important. I think if we can just, at least in our travels, to share with other people that sort of thing. If one life is changed, then millions of lives are changed.
Buck was 8 or 9, and Jackson was what? 14?
Buck was 8 when we left, and Jack was 13.
And now they're 11 and 16.
16.
Has that experience had a residual effect on them?
A profound. Profound. You know, they're kids, and they're the same people, but they have a different outlook on things. And I think it's changed them in many ways. And I think them sharing their story with their friends has also changed the thinking of their friends.
What about all the girls that you have helped over the years, both personally and through your vast – Girls on the Run has expanded from Charlotte to become this international organization. So you don't even know all of the girls anymore who participate in this. But what has been, what have they taken, because they grow out of the program.
Sure they
so
do.
What have they taken with them as they become young adults?
You know, one girl said it best. She said that Girls on the Run gave her the courage and the tools to be the boss of her own brain. And what that means to me is that all these girls who are now like these amazing women are leading their lives with intention. So they're very conscious of the choices they make.
And when they came to you, mm-hmm. they were what? Junior high school?
Oh no, they were little. They were 8, 9, and 10 years old.
And did they come with insecurities and problems that they were aware of, or did they just want to run and be part of something?
Oh, they just came as playful, joyful, awesome beings that they are. And what Girls on the Run does is just give them permission to be that for their whole life.
Wow. Mala, you suggested that I Google the characteristics of the social entrepreneur. So I did. And they are a willingness to self-correct, a willingness to share credit, a willingness to break free of established structures, a willingness to cross disciplinary boundaries, which you can talk about, a willingness to work quietly, and having a strong ethical impetus, a clear sense of right and wrong. Did you always have those qualities?
Yes, I did. And, you know, another one of the characteristics of a social entrepreneur, I'm a member of something called Ashoka, which is a fellowship of social entrepreneurs. And another, JD and I have laughed about this. As children, we asked some really what would be bizarre but deep questions. Things really used to bother me as a child, like infinity.
yes, I read space.
Endless space.
I read one of your blogs when you're having this conversation, and maybe you made it up thinking back to your childhood, or maybe it's you actually remembered it, with a girlfriend.
No, it's true.
And you're just asking all these imponderable questions that cannot be answered, and you won't stop. This is your brain, right?
That's it. We ask these really, like, infinity. So you can tell I get psyched up about it. And what the social entrepreneur does is try to make sense of this so that they can then take these concepts that are almost invisible and bring them into some sort of tangible form for other people to identify with and to grow from. Mm-hmm. And, so I ask these questions. I mean, I would literally lay awake at night consumed with, you know, black holes and celestial planets and things like that as a child. And JD and I have both laughed about this. You know,
we have indeed. In fact, we were just sharing the other day of my first anxiety attack when I was 11 or 12 years old, laying in bed thinking, endless space. How is that a concept? Holy cow. Like if it goes to the end of the world, then what happens? There's got to be something on the other side. And we laughed so hard about it because it is one of those things. We don't think in terms of infinite. We think in terms of a finite thing. Yeah. So for us to have that concept is just nuts.
Yeah, it goes forever. No walls. Right. So you are telling me that you're sharing the same neuroses.
Absolutely. It is, yeah.
But then you didn't, I mean, if I understand this correctly, your entry into social entrepreneurship came because Jackson asked you a question that you couldn't really answer.
Absolutely.
And you wanted to answer the question and demonstrate the answer through what you did with 12 and 12. So did he awaken something that was already there, or would you think you would have gotten there on your own?
You know, I said to Jackson the other day, I said, one powerful thought can change the world. And something that came out of his mouth changed the course of our entire family's life. And to me, that's really profound. I just think that that's amazing. And I said to my kids the other day, we were out to dinner, and I said, you guys, we've set a world record. We're the first family in history to have traveled to all 7 continents in 1 year, specifically to do humanitarian work. And I said, isn't that amazing? We're the first guys in history ever to have done on this planet to have ever done what we did. And I said, Jackson, that all came from you having a simple but powerful idea.
I sure hope Disney is listening, because American Family Lewis, there's got to be a movie. Molly also added that social entrepreneurs can be driven to the point of neurosis. We're talking about relationships can be challenging, money means very little, and social entrepreneurs are passionate beyond what is healthy sometimes, but those are the very traits that make you successful. You think that's true, JD?
Absolutely. And I think it describes us both to a T, doesn't it? You know, we've both been working on projects, and, you know, we talk to each other, and it really is, you know, we're working 18-hour days just wearing ourselves out. And that description is true. I mean, it's not motivated by money. It's certainly not motivated for the success. It's really you lock into an idea and you get excited about it, and it's almost a manic experience. You just go, this is where I need to go.
You say it's not motivated by money, but at the end of the day, and hopefully three times a day, you got to eat.
Right.
So
that's why I teach acting. Okay. Because I'm certainly not me. You know, the thing that with our project, 12 Good Deeds, is all these kids are raising money, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. But all of the money that comes in goes directly to one of our 12 projects. So I'm left to fund the administrative part by myself because I feel strongly about it. And so it certainly is not motivated by money. In fact, we were talking. I'm going broke as we speak, but
please send your money. No, I'm
kidding. No, there you go.
Ashoka, you mentioned Ashoka, A-S-H-O-K-A. It's the largest network of social entrepreneurs in the world, and you're a fellow there. Mm-hmm. You're a member of that organization. And it says that social entrepreneurs are ambitious and persistent, tackling major social issues and offering new ideas for wide-scale change. That obviously fits what you set out to do with Girls on the Run and what you set out to do with 12 and 12 and now with 12 Good Deeds, which we'll talk about. How did the Ashoka relationship come about? Because they found out about you, or did you seek them out?
You know, they found out about me. So the president of Ashoka lives in the D.C. area, mm-hmm. and her son was asking why they can't have a Boys on the Run, and she did some research and discovered Girls on the Run. So she reached out, and they did. It's a nomination. It's a difficult process to go through. They ask very hard questions. They're infinity worriers also. So, you know, they're big thinkers too. So they ask these questions that make you go very deeply into why you do what you do. And then I got not selected, which was tremendous.
It's the largest network of social entrepreneurs in the world. And yet, when I read it in your bio, I thought, what's that?
Yeah.
And I had to look it up.
Yeah.
And it's pretty nebulous when you get to their website. How come I haven't heard of it?
Well, they have, and I'll be honest, I think sometimes they have a difficult time explaining what they do because it is such a new field or new, you know, it's new naming. It's still, you know, trying to figure out what it is. But I think people like JD and I found each other, and we can immediately identify with what we do.
It grew out of Harvard, didn't it?
Yes. The founder of that, Bill Drayton, is a social entrepreneur as well, and he's been making change in the world forever.
Why the name Ashoka? What does it mean?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. It does have a history in a previous leader who had a transformative change. He went from being a battleground sort of bully to seeing how transformative change and love actually could change things. Mm-hmm. And so they named the organization after him.
Well, you've done a little transformative change in this 12 and 12. And when you went to these different countries, and you went to China, you went to, Haiti, you went to Tibet and many other places. And here you are, complete strangers, you don't speak the language, and yet you want to set out there and help these people do whatever they need help with. Was it as eye-opening for them as it was for you? Why would you be here? What are you doing here?
Yeah, I suppose it was and is eye-opening for them. I think they're super grateful that we were over there trying to make a difference. But when you're over there and you see what the deal is, you have to do. I had to come home and do what I could do to make a difference.
We're going to talk about what you're doing now and what you're doing now, and we'll talk more about social entrepreneurship as a concept and what it means when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the professional MBA program at USC's Darla Moore School of Business. Convenient location in Uptown Charlotte. Details at moore.sc.edu/PMBA. Art Pope is a very influential figure in North Carolina, has been for years. He was a state legislator. He is the president and CEO and chief executive. Well, that's the same thing, isn't it? Of a major corporation. He has a foundation. And now he is the state's budget director, appointed to the job by Governor McCrory, whose campaign Pope volunteered to work on. He will join us tomorrow to talk about his job as budget director and why he thinks he's so controversial in some circles. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, congressional Republicans call President Obama's handling of the crisis in Ukraine part of a failed foreign policy. The president's approach to world affairs and American power abroad.
You're invited to join the discussion on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Molly Barker, founder of Girls on the Run, is here. J.D. Lewis, founder of 12 in 12, is also here. We're talking about social entrepreneurship. They're both social entrepreneurs. And the 12 in 12 was where J.D. Took his two sons around the world. And as he said, they're the only family that have been to 12 different countries, doing 12 different entrepreneurial, but more importantly, charitable, helpful things around the world. What did you take away from that experience?
Wow, that's a pretty big question. We took away so much. I think the most important thing we took away was that people are people all over the world, regardless of where they live, what they believe, who they are. I think people are innately good and kind and loving. And the other thing we took, obviously, is that there are people in need and we have the ability to help them. And we should help them for no other reason than that's our duty as people on the planet.
And Buck, who's the youngest of your sons, says he's committed now to making a difference in the world. Now, he was 9 years old when he said that. He's, what, 11 now?
Right.
He's got a long life, one hopes, ahead of him. So do you think he can stick to that commitment?
Let's hope so. You know, I do, though, because he's got a really good heart. And I think this trip really helped him see that he could do something in the world. And he's been very involved in the program that we've put together. And my kids, I have to say, are really hard workers. And they want to do good things. And I think that for a parent, I think that's a really incredible thing to see in your kids.
Mm-hmm. How many different social entrepreneurs do you think are out there, and how many know that they're social entrepreneurs versus simply doing what they feel passionate about and feel that they need, that they're called to do?
I think there's a lot of people that have the potential, the capacity to do this. They just either one have fear or they don't have a support system. I think that's been the greatest gift that JD has brought into my life is, you know, I've been through a very challenging time the last couple weeks with a project I've been working on, and JD was the first person I could call. I could cry and speak freely, and he understood. And I think that's what part of my job going forward is to give people the courage to say, you know, I've got an idea. Now how can I bring that to life?
Mm-hmm. Are people who work for things like Meals on Wheels or just do charitable things for their church or with their church, are they social entrepreneurs or are they simply volunteers in a charitable situation? What's the difference?
I think they're two different things, okay. But they're both absolutely necessary, because if we don't take care of each other, you know, people need to take care of each other. But there's a little bit of an edge to a social entrepreneur which goes just a bit deeper, which is saying it's about creating changes in thinking, mm-hmm. and behavior that is life ongoing. So, for example, a homeless helping the homeless is one form of charitable work, but eliminating homeless is more of what a social entrepreneur would do, you know, looking at ways to eliminate it.
And we've had another social entrepreneur on this program, although I'm sure he didn't think of himself as such when we had him on. And I can't think of his name, but his organization is called Wine to Water. He was a bartender.
Doc Henley.
Yes, Doc Henley. Mm-hmm. He was a bartender, and he just thought, I need to do something. Mm-hmm. And I think he took up a collection at the bar one night, and he investigated where people needed water, and he went over and he learned that it was better not to give them water but to teach them how to build wells. Right. So if the well went dry or something happened to the well, they could move it and they could build their own well and get clean, fresh water. And he's had a significant impact over the years. Obviously, he's not wealthy. You're not wealthy. You don't have to be wealthy to be a social entrepreneur, but how do you do what you want to do and still fund yourself? Because you got to have a roof over your head. You have to have clothes to wear. You got to eat.
I think the most important thing and the biggest characteristics of social entrepreneurs is they have a passion for what they're doing, and they're willing, like Molly just said, to plow through the fear of it, to actually take a stand and do something of importance. There's a lot of fear attached to that. It's scary to go out and put yourself out there and say, I want to create a program that's on a bigger scale.
Well, somebody had to fund 12 and 12. You didn't have the money to travel to all these different continents and all these different countries, and somebody had to help you, actually not through money necessarily, but right. They had to help you into these countries and into the situations that you got yourself into. But in terms of the money to fund it, what was it like to go out there and say, here's what I want to do? I've never done it before.
Right.
Have no idea if this is going to work, but I need some funding. I need to get a plane ticket.
Right.
How do you do that?
I'll tell you, and what I've said all along in speaking engagements is that you have to have a passion for what you want to do. And I think when you have a really strong passion, you have the ability to go out and say, I need some support.
What happens when you get turned down? And you do get turned down.
You call Molly Barker and go, I've been turned down. What do I do, Molly? I think what you do is the passion is bigger than somebody saying no. And I've always taught people in my work that no means nothing. No is a yes waiting to happen. You know, I can't stop my passion or my project because one person says I'm not available to it, because there are other people along the way that will be available to it.
You have expanded 12 into 12 into 12 Good Deeds, which is a program we'll talk about. But in the course of setting up that program, because it's in 12 different schools, six of them are here, six of the other ones are scattered around the country in places
right.
pretty far flung, Minnesota, Michigan.
Right.
In New Jersey, you went to Manchester High School.
Right.
And you told the kids in the auditorium that being famous, being a celebrity, being rich is not what matters. Being able to say, your kids are dying and I'm going to help you, that's what matters. Now, in this celebrity soused culture in which we live,
right.
how did that go over?
It really did. And I think people get that more now. You know, I've worked in an industry my whole life with celebrities, and I've seen the deal firsthand. And being successful in the industry is great, and that's all good. But you eventually realize there's more to life than being a celebrity or the money. And I think a lot of conscious celebrities figure that out and want to do more in the world.
Well, Brad Pitt's a good example of that.
Great example. There
Angelina
are a number
Jolie.
Of great examples.
Yeah.
You know, I think it also comes with maturity. I think you eventually grow up and realize that the gift of giving is truly what makes people happy. You know, I found that in working in the Kibera slums in Nairobi. People are genuinely happy there. And you think, how can these people possibly be happy in these conditions? They don't have money. They don't have things in their homes.
Right.
They're not traveling on expensive vacations. How could they possibly be happy? And the truth is, happiness has nothing to do with any of these things that we're taught.
Well, you hear all the time, particularly in the early days of the media culture, people who came up into it, like country musicians, would say, you know, we didn't know we were poor.
Right.
We had nothing. We lived in a shack, but we didn't know it. We were happy. And it's hard for this culture to conceive of that. But then on the other hand, these people are happy. Why are you helping them?
Good point. Well, they are happy, but they are in need. And,
yeah.
and you know, the truth of the matter is people are dying every day over there, and we have the ability to help. And if I can save, or you can save, or any of us can save one or two lives, why would we not do that? You know, I said to a school the other day, we were at an assembly, and I said, people are dying of malaria. Here in this country, two pills, a double dose of malaria medication, will get rid of it in you or me. So if we have the ability to do that here, and perhaps the drugs cost $12, mm-hmm. how are we not raising the money or doing more to help a single life? I mean, I'm willing to raise $12 to save a life. Yeah. I think everybody here in Charlotte is willing to raise $12 to save a life. I think it's important that we're aware that our simple tasks can make a difference in the world.
And I just want to speak up. I think one thing J.D. doesn't even see in himself, actually, but I see, is what he's doing is creating an image for people that goes so far beyond and much richer and deeper than how our media and how our system is set up to see people. I mean, he's giving people an opportunity to tap into their greatest good. And I think sometimes kids in particular, elementary, middle, high school, don't know that they even have that in them. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he gives them that option.
This doesn't sound too dissimilar to what you tried to achieve with girls and Girls on the Run, mm-hmm. tapping into that inner strength that they have that they don't know mm-hmm. that they have and that they sometimes don't get because they're being bombarded from the outside to conform to some unreal reality. Mm-hmm. Is that why you joined forces? You're on his board now.
Well, and you know, the thing, yeah, well, that's one reason, certainly. The other is that I really like JD, you know, and
you don't like me, you love me.
I do. I love JD, and you know,
I love her back.
There's a quote that says, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but we have to first believe in the person, and then we'll believe in the vision. And so social entrepreneurs, this will choke me up. I mean, it's an incredible burden. It's sometimes very frightening to be that person because people put a lot of responsibility on you to be everything that your vision is about. And I think one of the things that I've been able to experience with JD is I'm human too, you know, and I don't have it figured out. You know, I'm just trying to be and live into the vision that I'm simply the messenger for. I'm not sure if that made sense, mm-hmm. but yeah.
Mm-hmm. You were going to come on this program today, and you were going to talk about, in mm-hmm. part, something called Run to Lead, which mm-hmm. is an organization that you were putting together, and you got people from all over the country involved in this, and it's pretty ambitious, and yet you called us yesterday to say, I'm pulling the plug.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an idea. That's an example of just exactly what you're talking about here.
It is. It is.
What was Run to Lead?
So Run to Lead was an idea that I had about a year ago. I've been asked to serve on a number of serve on the Commission for Political Reform, which was looking at how we could encourage more civil dialogue at the highest levels of government. And an idea was planted into my brain back then, and I began to cultivate that with a number of people. It was interesting, and this is where I'm being incredibly vulnerable right now and very raw, and I'm very afraid as I share this. It began to morph into something that wasn't as grounded or rooted in my initial intention. And so what happens is I'm just human like everybody else. I begin to doubt and I begin to have fear and I begin to question, is what I'm asking of people too much? So over the course of this year, it began to just water itself down. And so yesterday, over the past couple weeks, I've had to make a really difficult decision, and that is that it's not ready to birth. And I've realized that what I've created it's not audacious enough. It's not bold enough. It's not rich enough. And so I'm not going back to the drawing board for the idea. The idea is still present, but how it will manifest is still got some work.
And because you involved other people, I think Girls on the Run was pretty much you and maybe one or two other people at the beginning.
Yes.
This required, because this was an idea that you had, to have young people, fourth graders, mm-hmm. start getting involved in the political process mm-hmm. and to have them run, and then to also have Congress people mm-hmm. run mm-hmm. and run with these fourth graders, mm-hmm. I guess to give, I'm sure there's a lot more to this, I'm just doing
yeah,
it here, to give young people an exposure to politics. It was a nonpartisan effort mm-hmm. so that dialogue could start between the two sides and between young people and older people, and they can get firsthand knowledge of how the system works. All well and good, but evidently you got a lot of people involved in this, and as things do in anything that you start involving other people with, unless you have an iron fist, it starts to get out of your hands, doesn't it?
Yes, and so did the sort of the vision for it. And that is has been so interesting to have started Girls on the Run, which was really me in the beginning, and then Dory Luke came on board and some others. It was fantastic. But this required collaboration. It's interesting. It required all the things I'm asking of our national leaders, but the vision wasn't quite solid enough. You know, it wasn't quite crafted enough.
So you have this wonderful website for this. Yeah. For this. So what do you do? Are you just stop it for a second, regroup, and go back to it? Is that what you're going to do?
Yeah, so I've sent out the emails yesterday that we're regrouping. And, you know, I was terrified in sending those. But everybody, because it is a social effort, a social entrepreneurial effort, has been like, I think that was very brave. You know, you certainly don't want to bring something into the world until it's ready to birth. Mm-hmm. What I've discovered, though, is that I think I'm actually going all the way back to the drawing board. I don't think that the vehicle we were using is, like I said, quite audacious enough. I want to provoke a more maybe controversial conversation than what.
And what was the reaction of the partners that you have in this venture? Because there were some fairly high profile people.
Yes, you know, this is what's great is when I started the whole thing, I was speaking from my heart, and I was speaking from that really real space. And so you can't deny that from anyone. So when I came back and said we're going to delay and speak from the same space, they all were like okay with it.
Well, politicians know how to do talking points, and I guess you're realigning your talking points. You have started, and we've alluded to this a little bit, something new that is an outgrowth of the 12 and 12 idea called 12 Good Deeds, JD. It's a program that gets students to engage in 12 good deeds at 12 schools across the country, 6 here in Charlotte, 6 elsewhere, and you just launched it last month.
Yes.
What is your vision for this?
Well, when we came back, we wanted to see what we could do to make a difference. And so initially we did a few fundraising things and helped some schools in Rwanda and helped in Haiti. But I wanted to do it on a larger scale to be able to fund all 12 of our organizations. And I kept on thinking that, first off, kids need to know more about the world. I've asked a number of principals across the country if they know where Tanzania is. A few of them did, actually, and a lot of them didn't. The principals.
Okay, great.
I didn't know where Tanzania was when I sat down with the head of the Peace Corps, mm-hmm. and she said, "Oh, you should really go to Tanzania." And I said, "I'm not quite sure where that is, actually." Funny enough, a lot of people don't. And I think that it's important that we start teaching our kids about the world. The world has become a smaller place because of the internet. And education is really heading in that direction. So I wanted to create a program that intertwined global education, introducing kids to global relief work. And also, the basis of the program is teaching kids to be givers, to do something specific in the community. And I think that's the biggest part of the program. And what I thought is, why not set up a program where kids could do simple good deeds in their community and it could affect the world? And how the program works is a child will commit to do 12 good deeds.
Let's hold that idea because okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about how the program works and how these kids will find out how they can make a difference. Just by doing these 12 good deeds, they will have made a difference, and maybe it will grow from there. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexon Pruitt, 190 lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and 7 other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexon Pruitt. Congressional Republicans call President Obama's handling of the crisis in Ukraine part of a failed foreign policy. A look at the president's approach to world affairs and American power abroad coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you would like to join our conversation about social entrepreneurship or about particularly these two individuals that we have with us and what they have done, J.D. Lewis and Molly Barker with 12 and 12 and Girls on the Run, well, now's the time. Get on board at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, and we're coming right back.
Hey, As they look for the best job applicants they can get, bankers are trading in their suits for jeans.
The market that we're in is really competing for programmers, which is a very, very competitive market.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, old school bankers versus new school technology. In the world of high frequency trading, that's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Molly Barker, founder of Girls on the Run, and also a project called Naked Face, which we talked about several, maybe a year or two ago. I can't remember. Well, you went without makeup, and now the Today Show is doing it. J.D. Lewis is the founder of 12 and 12, and now he started something else called 12, help me.
Good deeds.
Good
oh,
deeds.
Good deeds.
I have no mind anymore. It's just completely gone. Your goal here is to connect kids to humanitarian work and to find out small ways, that just small things that they can do, that they can actually see they've made a difference, and maybe that will inspire them to do other things that even are even bigger. So talk about that, what you're going to tell us before the break.
So kids commit to do 12 good deeds in 12 weeks, simple things like writing a letter of appreciation to a family member, picking up trash in a park, spending time with an elderly person, and they get 12 sponsors that give them $1 per good deed. All of the money that's raised by these kids goes directly to one of our 12 projects around the world. But the great part of the project is they get to actually interact with the projects around the world. So they're getting introduced firsthand to global relief work. So they're actually being involved. And I think for me, and I think for a lot of schools right now, they're really responding to it because it is a program that's not happening right now. Kids aren't getting a lot of global education. Kids aren't being engaged on that level. And to actually be able to have a kid sit down and interact on the internet with these organizations, obviously through our website and its monitor because it's kids, they get the opportunity to feel like they've worked locally, but they really and truly are making a difference.
So let me make sure we understand this. The 12 good deeds really have nothing to do physically, directly, with what's going on in your 12 and 12 program. But as a result of having done the 12 good deeds and gotten the funding and all the money goes into that, then they get to participate in what's going on elsewhere in the world that you've already started.
Right, but it does – it is part of the program because the goal is to engage people, whether it's locally or globally. So doing good deeds is beautiful in your community, and it's beautiful in the world. So,
and to participate in this, there are 11 predetermined good deeds, right, and the 12th they get to choose themselves. But the 11 include collecting canned goods for donations.
Right.
Spending quality time, as you said, with an elderly person. Write 12 good things that you like
about
yourself. Is that an easy thing for kids to do?
It's not. And I think that that's why we put it into the program. And it's a self-esteem building portion of the program for kids to really realize they're great and powerful people that can do great things in the world.
Write a thank you card to a school custodian or someone like that.
Right.
Really interesting. Pick up trash in a public park. Let me see here. Donate used clothing, toys, or books. Plant a tree or a vegetable or herb garden. Write a letter of appreciation to a family member. Just writing a letter has got to be a foreign experience.
Or email.
Create a gratitude board. What is that?
A gratitude board is something specific to our program. I don't know if you remember years ago there was the vision board when you would cut out pieces of either sayings or pictures of things you wanted and paste them on a board and look at it every day and sort of visualize what you want in your life. We sort of did a different take on it, and it's really about what are you grateful for in your life, and cutting out pictures, statements from a magazine, or words to remind you of all the great stuff you have in your life. And what we want to do is have kids across the country making these boards, taking photos of them, and putting them on the net to share with other kids around the country.
Wash a neighbor's – volunteer to wash a neighbor's car or do yard work. Here's one that's really interesting. Do a random anonymous act or acts of kindness. Do something nice and don't tell anybody you did it.
And again, this goes back to the gift of giving. It's not about what we get in return. What we get in return, hopefully, is the sense of doing something because you want to do it and it's important to do. And not one of the things that in our program, there's no incentive to be the biggest seller. You're not going to get something for raising the most money. You're not going to get a free trip to Disney World for you and your family because you did the most. What we want to sort of instill is giving is part of who we are as people. It's what we do. Caring is part of our human nature, and we need to nurture that, especially in this society because, you know, we're raised, all of us in the States are raised to gather, get more, want more.
How do you or the person giving the dollar for each good deed know, particularly with the anonymous act of kindness, know that the good deed has been done?
Well, that's the honor system, ladies and
okay.
gentlemen.
All right. Because a lot of this does sound like the Boy Scouts. I mean, it really does. And the 12th, I know this just started, so maybe it's too early to ask you this question, but the 12th idea is a good deed that they have to come up with.
Right.
Have any idea what they're coming up with?
They've come up with all kinds of great stuff as far as making a sweater for someone or baking for the family, cooking dinner for your family. Everybody's come up with some really interesting ones. But really what we want to do is engage kids to come up with ideas of how else can we make a difference? Like get excited about like what else could I do that would be really great for my community or my friends or my family?
Now, you got 6 schools in Charlotte. People know you here because you've been here for a while. And people know you from 12 and 12 and because you've been in the papers, you've been on this show, you've been on other in other media. So I can understand how schools, you could get 6 schools in this area to let you in the door and maybe kick this project off. But you're involved in schools in Minnesota, in Michigan, in Wisconsin. New Jersey. I've lost it.
California, Oregon.
So how? and why there?
Because we've really just been putting the idea out to a few specific schools, and I have to tell you, the response has been amazing. We've had no no's. I think it's touched a chord with a lot of administrators across the country, and everybody's really been on board. What we're going to do is launch the full project in September. This has just been the inaugural sort
of flagship.
Like
a pilot program.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And those 12 schools will go down in history as being the first 12 schools to have done the program. They're called our flagship schools.
So you went to that high school in New Jersey. I guess you've been to all these other high schools, and you've talked to these kids. How many kids are involved in this around the country?
Hundreds. You know, it's funny because the program states that you have to have a minimum of 12 kids to do the program. So when I've gone to these assemblies and spoken in front of 500, 600, 700 kids, I was really surprised at how many kids jumped on board. Minnesota, we have 150 kids. Here in Charlotte, some of the elementary schools, we have 165, 170 kids doing the program. Kids are excited about doing it. And to me, that's thrilling that we have kids here that really feel the desire to want to make a difference. And I have to tell you, I've spoken to the children. I wasn't addressing the parents. These kids got excited about doing it. And I think also the parents are excited because it's teaching kids some real core values.
Hmm. And then, of course, the money they raise goes to the 12 and 12 projects that you and your kids were involved in when you were going around the world to do this, spending a month in each of these areas doing something good for the and some of the places that you went. Let's talk about that. You're supporting, through this 12 Good Deeds program,
right,
ongoing work with an orphanage in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Right.
The New Hope Foundation in Beijing, a home for babies and toddlers there. How do officials, particularly in Russia, they don't like us very much anymore, and they banned American adoptions of kids in their orphanages. So how do they feel about this American guy not only coming in with his 2 kids to help for a month, but now sending money over there to those
organization. I think they're all really appreciative. And I think need is need. And if somebody comes in and says, I want to help you, then everybody has been incredibly gracious. I think if somebody comes in and goes, how can I make a difference for you? How can I help your program, I think people are pretty receptive to that.
And how are you making a difference? Because we don't know how much money is going over there, and this pilot program will be nothing, hopefully, compared in comparison to what's going to happen September. When it launches.
We have different finite projects in each of our locations. For instance, transit in St. Petersburg.
Transit's the name of the orphanage.
Uh-huh. It's for runaway teens who've come into the city to sort of try and make money on the streets. Mm-hmm. We're creating a summer program for the kids. So they're actually kind of in a lockup situation because they're underage, and this organization helps them get back to a family member and back to a safe environment where they've come from. But in the meantime, they have to process papers, and that takes quite a long period of time. Some of these kids are there for anywhere from 8 months to a few years while papers are being processed. So we're creating a summer program where these kids actually get to go out and go camping. So we're supplying tents and sleeping bags and a program so kids can actually get out and be in nature for a while.
You're also working with and so helping to support a project at the Special Education Center in Thailand. That's another orphanage for children. A Tibetan English school in India, not for children, but for former political prisoners.
Right. In fact, I'm heading over there in a few weeks to actually oversee the program there.
And you were introduced to that program during 12 and 12.
I was indeed. We went to see the Dalai Lama up there, and that was in the north of India. And so we got to teach English to Tibetan refugees.
And this is where you put Buck to work as a tea server?
In a cafe. He was hired as a – that's funny you remember that. That's great.
That's pretty remarkable.
That's one of his favorite memories, by the way.
The Sungu Village Project in Rwanda, it's a primary school for children. Another project, We Act, a youth program, an HIV workshop in Kigali, Rwanda. They provide care for 2,000 patients living with HIV.
And our program there, which I think is really interesting, is a food program. They just need food for the kids to be able to take their HIV medicines. Mm. So that program is really just supplying food for the kids to be able to...
You're working with the Creative Solutions Art School in Zanzibar, Tanzania, which is alternative education plus arts, English, and computer skills. Nimbani HIV Clinic in Nairobi, working for children suffering from HIV/AIDS. And then at Refugio de Monos in Argentina, this is a howler monkey refuge. Talk about that. I mean, why did you think this was important enough to include in all the other projects, which are humanitarian in nature, and this is for howler monkeys?
Right. Well, we wanted to have a broad range of what we were doing in the world, and that sounded like an interesting project, and we got to live with monkeys for a month, and that was really cool. But we wanted to have a sort of vast array of what we were doing, and a lot of kids, of course, are connected with that. They really like that. They're interested in that, and however people get connected with the project is how they do.
And you're also working for another home caring for 23 orphaned and abandoned children in Peru, in Haiti, a school for children in domestic servitude.
You know, that's one that I think a lot of people find interesting is that, and a lot of people aren't aware of it, but a lot of kids in Haiti are living in domestic servitude. They're called restivet kids. And what happens is families have too many kids, and so they literally give one of their kids to another family in exchange for room and board. So these kids are basically living in slavery. They're historically abused and treated badly. They don't eat with the families. They don't get an education. And they basically work for the family, cooking, cleaning, and taking care of their homes.
And there's also a project in Mississippi. How do you know that the money you're sending over there and that the money will go in to these areas because of what you're doing with 12 Good Deeds? How do you know it's going to the work that you want it to go to?
Well, the beauty of the project
particularly
is
in Haiti, where money seems to disappear.
Because we've lived in all of these places and there are projects that we've worked with, we know specific people there. I'm overseeing all of the projects, but we have people going over to a number of the projects to oversee. Also, we have people there that we trust, that we know, that we've lived with, who are our sort of managers of our projects. So I have made really certain that there are checks and balances in all of the places, because that is an issue. And certainly in Haiti, when we've raised a lot of money to help the people over there and a lot of it has gone missing, I've been pretty,
Molly, you've described each other as our biggest supporters. In other words, you are your support systems for each going back and forth. How big a support system does this kind of work take?
Well, you know, I'm just sitting here watching JD talk about what he's doing, and I mean, I just love this man, and I just wish that for so many other people that, you know, what happens when he and I speak with each other, we really do go to a different world. It's a world that isn't caught up in some of the mundane, you know, issues of, you know, the car you drive or, you know, I mean, it's really rich conversation, and it allows us to really connect. And I'm listening to him talk about the people in these other countries. Of course you trust them because you've seen them. You've been face to face with these people. You've developed a relationship around giving. And those are the sorts of things that I think JD and I wish for the world and each other.
Susan emails, how do you make this your job so that you can live your passion? We can all have the passion, and we can have all the passion in the world, give till it hurts, and not know how to take the next step to being able to fund doing what our passion is so that we aren't working full-time and trying to make change in the world for the rest of the time. I guess that's kind of rambling, but nonetheless, how do you do it?
Well, I'll jump in there. So when I started Girls on the Run, I had multiple jobs. You know, I worked at the YMCA. I worked for a catering company and up until 2 a.m. and then got up at 6, you know, to work at the Y so that I could get Girls on the Run started. It was hard, but eventually the right people came along that could help develop the strategic plan for the fundraising.
And I have about 10 seconds. So does being a social entrepreneur preclude you from – maybe you don't have to do it yourself. Can you work for somebody else? Could somebody come to work for you and still consider themselves a social entrepreneur?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's, entrepreneurial is what you bring to the mix, I think, Molly.
Yeah. That's it. J.D. Lewis, founder of 12 and 12 and 12 Good Deeds. We'll keep following your progress there. Molly Barker, founder of Girls on the Run. Thank you both for the hour.